This is the Ideas Podcast, the show where learning and development professionals discuss ideas over a nice cup of tea. Warning, other beverages may be consumed. In this episode, I chat with Kara North about her recent move into the world of consulting and how we as instructional designers and learning professionals can support EDI movements in the workplace. Welcome to this episode of the Ideas Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Today, we have a guest on the show that I've wanted to have on the show for a very long time. But as you probably know, she's just a little bit busy. She does just a couple of things in our industry at any given time. By which, of course, I mean a couple of dozen things at the same time in our industry. So joining us today, we have Kara North, Chief Learning Consultant and founder of The Learning Camel, which is possibly my favourite name for a learning consultancy ever. Of course, you will know who she is, probably far more than you know who I am. You're probably tuning in because her name's on the episode, not because you've listened to this show before. But without further ado, I will hand over for a proper introduction. Kara, over to you.
Oh, well, hi, Tom, and hello, everybody. My name is Kara North, like he said, and I really hate introducing myself, so I'll just kind of keep it short and sweet. I've been doing learning and development for pretty much my entire professional career. I've worked in corporate higher education, and then I just recently made the switch to full-time consultant, and it's been a fun ride so far. And I really love everything learning and development. I've seen a lot of changes over my time, and I really enjoy also trying to give back to the community as much as I can, because I am a firm believer in paying it forward, and I certainly wouldn't be where I am today without the help of others. And so I'm in a place where I can help other people. So I believe in paying it forward.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And that's very, very a modest introduction there. You do a lot more than just paying forwards what you've got. I think there's a lot of us in the industry that were kind of figuring out what we were going to do and going, this person here, I shall follow them. I think on behalf of everyone, thank you for that. But the real reason everyone tunes in, what are you drinking during our conversation today?
Oh, great question. I actually just finished a beverage before we came on. So I'm addicted to the hemp water, and it is a water that has no sugar in it, but it's flavored. And my favorite flavor of hemp water is watermelon. And I buy it by the caseload. In fact, there's probably, I'd say, maybe 24 bottles or so of it in my fridge currently. I drink it a lot of it throughout the day, but I'm highly addicted to it. Everybody that I meet, I try to push it on them because I believe in it that much. And a couple of my friends are now addicted to it too.
Nice. Just single-handedly propping up that company there. That's yes. Like it. Well, it's the evening here, and it's warm, so I have gone for a lovely gin and tonic, nice. Which I'm not addicted to. You can't say that on the internet. People get very upset. Okay. So, yes, but it is very nice. It's enjoyable of an evening. So, the move into learning consultancy, I think everyone would agree it's a big move, right? Even just from the going from being an employee to being entirely responsible for yours and potentially other people's income, but also in what the role is. So I guess where I'd like to start is when you look at the industry right now and when you look at consulting, what's the big play? What do you want to see happening, or what are you going to make happen, maybe, is the answer.
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't want to give away too many secrets. No, I'm kidding. Mm. So it's interesting. I actually, and I'm not saying this as a flex, but truly I was excited to talk to this person. So I had a chance to talk to Will Thalheimer recently, and we had a pretty lovely chat about just kind of everything consulting. And there was one thing that the two of us kind of agreed on, and something that I'd really like to see shift in the consultant market. And that's kind of like almost like a Hippocratic oath of do no harm. So, for example, I recently had a discovery meeting with a potential client. They were explaining to me a situation, and it had something to do with training around dietary restrictions in a healthcare setting, because unfortunately what happened was someone had given a patient a wrong food. So this person was not supposed to have a banana, and this person was given a banana, and it made a pretty significant side effect for that patient. And they found me somehow and said, hey, we need to have dietary training. And then the first thing out of my mouth was, well, why do you think this is a problem? And so the person told me the story about the banana. And my immediate question was, well, so what happened? Like, why did it happen? And they just looked at me. They're like, you know, I don't know. Like, so-and-so told me that we need training and to find somebody to make it. And so that's why I'm contacting you. So I think that, you know, could I have taken that person's money and built something and pushed it out? Absolutely. But I just think that we really need to, as a profession, hold ourselves to higher standards than just content dumps. And, you know, maybe that's not going to make me a lot of money, but I'll sure sleep better at night. But I think that I'm seeing a lot of people talk about building like articulate rises or building videos or whatever. But at the end of the day, Tom, and I know you're also kind of the school of thought as well, like if it's not really solving a problem, what's the point?
No, I couldn't agree more. I kind of broadened when I made the statement far less eloquently recently, where I said, if your course contains the thing, oh, it's just an awareness piece, you shouldn't be making the bloody thing. That's probably why I'm not that consultancy, and why you're going to do very well, because you word it that way and I word it that way. But yeah, I think it's interesting that comes across as a not the usual idea, and a bit concerning, really, isn't it? Because you have to wonder, that means there are a lot of people either unaware of or perfectly comfortable creating content that doesn't do anything and billing for it.
Yes.
Which is a slightly uncomfortable feeling for our industry.
It is. And, you know, I can also share another client of mine is doing something kind of the complete opposite. So another, I think, emerging market that I'm finding is, you know, there are a lot of professions here in the United States, I venture to say probably in the UK as well, Tom, that a lot of people are aging out of the profession. So for example, there is a profession that I'm getting ready to support in some client work around assistive technology. So meaning, you know, fitting people appropriately for wheelchairs, you know, retrofitting like vehicles and really setting people up for success to live as independent lives as possible. And what you found is, much like the learning and development space, a lot of these practitioners fell into it. Like they were, you know, retired nurses or had a loved one that had maybe experienced some kind of declining health or had some significant trauma in their life to make it to where they need assistive technology in order to, you know, live their lives as much as they can. So I found it fascinating that they said, you know, people don't know what we do. And I was like, huh, well, I know what that feels like. I can completely empathize with that. So what they're looking to do is kind of build out like these awareness courses about, you know, what their profession is and to potentially get it accredited. And some of the work that I've done in a past life was, around accreditation when I worked in higher education. So I'm just like excited about doing that because, you know, maybe not everything has to solve a problem, but to your point about the awareness courses, this to me is an awareness course I can get behind because we're educating people about potential profession. And it's something that I don't see anyone talking about. Like all I see is like, oh, I want to be a UX designer, or I want to be an instructional designer, I want to be a technical writer or a marketer. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of value in serving people and helping people. And so this kind of profession might be the right fit for somebody, but they might not know that it's out there. So if my work can help amplify this and again, make more good in the world and help people, what's better than that?
No, I think that, you know, that it's a really interesting kind of area because I think L&D has one of those, well, learning is one of those rare things that has just as much, if not more, value outside of the workplace, where like the one, you know, quote unquote corporate function that is actually true of. You know, you, as important as your product may be, outside of what your business does, chances are it doesn't revolutionize many people's lives. But I think stuff that has such a potential. It's funny you kind of mentioned the kind of everyone wants to, L&D is a great example, everyone wants to be an instructional designer. If you're going into L&D, it's like it's the one job that exists in the entire space. When, as we all know, there are this huge spectrum of other jobs, some of which suit very different kinds of people. And I think it's interesting to find another industry like that, but that wants to do something about it. And that simultaneously L&D seems to not want to do anything about it. It's kind of, at least en masse, I think.
I'm trying to remember. I think it was Tracy Cantu who posted something a couple months back and I reshared it. It was brilliant. Just the broad scope of learning and development. Mm. You could be a learning technology architect or an LMS administrator or, you know, somebody that just exclusively does onboarding or somebody that maybe does employee success, or, you know, there's this just wide, vast net of what encompasses L&D, to your point, Tom, beyond an instructional designer that often needs good people, often pays pretty well, and often are maybe underappreciated and maybe not, I'll say, the fanciest or most, I guess, flamboyant out there. Maybe you might not see the work like you would with an instructional designer, e-learning developer, but still critical pieces of a good functioning, mature learning development function in organizations.
And I think part of really good development into any other role as well, like I was saying to someone earlier today, I'm so grateful for my time as a training facilitator, as someone who now creates the content. Like I feel like I would not be anywhere near as good as what I do now, just objectively, if I hadn't spent that time stood in front of rooms of people trying to train them and finding, well, this doesn't work, even though in theory it should. You know, I think that learning can so easily be lost when we kind of jump straight into a role. And I guess it's the same true in the kind of the assistive technology world. If someone just finds themselves in that role with no understanding of the breadth of it, they're going to be lost. So that sounds like an awesome project.
Yeah, absolutely. And to that point, you know, back in the Stone Age when I worked at Amazon, you know, my role as an instructional designer there was I helped manage the learning management system. And I don't know about you, but so often I find people just kind of saying, well, I don't ever want to touch the learning management system. Ew. But having that knowledge and knowing that, and back in the day, we actually used Moodle, if you can believe that. And that was a beast to administer. Mm-hmm. And having that experience, like you said, Tom, has really helped kind of make me a more well-rounded professional. And so I think oftentimes, you know, especially I think new folks looking to transition into a learning development role, it's like they're scared to try something different because they just have these blinders on looking only at instructional design. But I found like some of these other roles really can set you up for success, especially if you're looking to transition to learning leadership. Because learning leadership, like you have to kind of know a little bit about what everybody is doing. Okay, let me back that up. You should know a little bit about what everyone is doing. I wouldn't say that all learning development leaders do know that, but I feel like that's what made me a good leader in the positions that I was in, because I did know a little bit about everything. And even bonus, if someone was out, like let's say the LMS administrator was out for a week, guess what? I could pop in and get things done if I had to. Probably not as efficiently as they do because they're in it every day. But I mean, you know, I believe, you know, leaders step in when things need to be done. And, you know, I'm not going to put my head in the sand like an ostrich and be like, oh, sorry, they're out on vacation. Can't do anything for a week. Shucks. Really not that big of a deal, right? Yeah, it's going to be a poor reflection on you. And it's also going to make the team look bad. So why would you want to do that?
Yeah. And I think even outside of that, being able to empathize with what everyone on your team does and say, look, to some extent, I get it. You do it every day, and thankfully I don't anymore, maybe, but I can at least say, oh, you know what, I dealt with something similar. Let's, even if it's just a case of, yep, have a rant. That's absolutely fine. It really helps with that in the long term anyway, I find relating with team members. Having gone into this exciting world of consulting, how do you, I guess, see the next, 3-4 years of the L&D world. Because it feels like we've just gone through the most bizarre couple of years I've ever had working in the industry, where we're super important and then we're not doing a good job and then we're doing a great job and then everything's going digital and now nothing's working and no one understands why, except everyone does understand why, we just don't want to say it out loud. And it feels like we're approaching something more like a normal working world right now. But yeah, what next, I guess, is the question.
I wish I had a crystal ball, but unfortunately I don't. I mean, I think in a perfect world, I would hope that we could do a more blended learning experiences. I do think that there's a value to a face-to-face or a virtual instructor-led. I am not of the school of thought that that is dead. I get so mad when I hear people say that that's dead. I think it certainly has a place in the learning and development ecosystem. And I think that there are certain tasks and things that really benefit from that modality versus e-learning. When I think of e-learning, I just think of it as like a delivery method more than anything, right? I mean, it's just kind of a convenience thing. But I'll tell you one thing I'm really concerned about, and I kind of hinted about this earlier, is I just find that with the influx of people looking to do this work, there is such an emphasis on the building and the final product. And I worry about us being very transactional. I think some people are already there. And in my mind, when we're transactional, we don't have value back to our organizations. And then we are prime for the pump for layoffs or job cuts or whatever that looks like. So really being able to be what I think, Tom, a business partner, and really, you know, acting on those consultant chops to really focus on the value that we can give in, you know, having kind of this unbiased opinion about what's going on in our organizations. I think often, you know, I see some job postings saying you must be a subject matter expert in this before you train on it. I completely disagree with that, and here's why. A lot of times experts are just so inundated and all the things that they do is automatic. It's really hard for them to step back and really understand the nuances and minutia of what they actually do in a day-to-day. And I think that is the benefit of a good instructional designer, is they keep asking the question, why and how, and explain this to me. And that is really the value that we bring to these situations. But when we have people like writing out all of our content for us not asking questions, and we just again this copy and paste model of, oh look, I've put in an e-learning authoring tool, oh look, it's got jazz hands, and oh look, it's so cute, that's where we get into trouble. And I'm very, very afraid of what the future holds if we don't get out of that mindset. I'm seeing way too much of it on social media, and I don't know if social media really reflects what's going on in organizations sometimes, but you know, I do know that there are leaders of companies on social media. They're watching, they're looking at what people are putting out there. And I think as much as we can fight kind of that shiny crow syndrome of everything, I think the better we're going to be. But, you know, I'm very, very concerned about the transactional piece that I keep seeing.
And so I think that it's a really timely thing to consider. Because I mean, literally yesterday I was on one of the LDA meetings with Clark Quinn, and Ruth Clark was there. And they were talking about getting information from SMEs, and they touched on this idea that about 70% of an SME's knowledge is unconscious. They're not going to tell you it unless you dig for it. It just made me think like that is what an instructional designer is for. It's got nothing to do with, as you say, look what I can do in storyline, or behold my magnificent portfolio that I spent 6 months creating but didn't actually deploy any of, so there are no results to talk about. It's interesting. I only say this because I'm a little bit bitter because I'm recruiting at the minute and I'm running into this problem. It is a challenge. And I think that although social media doesn't, it doesn't mirror the real world, of course it doesn't, but it does heavily impact people new to the industry, because that is where they're turning for their information. Yeah. Because there is, I think, a lack of cohesion in the what I would consider to be the correct messaging. Like, where if you want to become a great instructional designer or a great L&D practitioner, where do you go?
I don't think you go to social media. I said that.
This is it. But if you start searching on the internet, you're going to find a lot of social media stuff before you find the real, before you get to the, you need to read some books. And that doesn't sound very exciting, does it? Compared to watch this video and take this online course and this kind of thing. It's very difficult, I think, getting into the industry now to make the right choice.
It is. There's a lot of noise out there, and it breaks my heart every time I hear somebody say, I've never heard of Michael Allen before. And I'm like, what? Like, you know, so I always try to at least once a month, if not more, try to elevate some of what I call the OGs of the industry, because I do worry about exactly what you said of all the noise. And there's a lot of, I'll say, search engine optimization trickery going on to really steer that message. And I think it's really sad. And, you know, I've definitely been an outspoken critic of it, for better or for worse. And I've made some enemies by being that way. But I'll say it here, and I've said it before. I was here before the ID Academies, and I'll be here after. So we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, my way of combating it is, you know, I've started to partner with higher education. So I adjunct at Boise State University, and I'm only obviously one person. But, you know, one thing that I'm doing, I'm teaching a storyboarding and scenario class, is I'm trying to make it as practical as possible. So good news is we're actually using text of Ruth Clark, which is incredible. But then I'm crosswalking that amazing like learning theory and research to what it looks like applied on the job. And I think that that's really critical to your point about recruiting and looking for talent. I had a tough time in my last role. I was trying to fill a position as well. And just basic things such as, you know, one big red flag I look for is in your resume. If you say you can do all this amazing stuff and I don't see anything of it in your portfolio, that's a problem. If you have a portfolio and it only shows me the end product and I have no information about, like you said, Tom, about how it was evaluated, struggles, challenges, etc., that's a problem. One question that really was my kind of end all be all in my last round of interviews, a question that I ask is, I don't believe in giving people assignments on the job for job interviews because I have an equity issue with that. I don't know what people have going on outside of applying for jobs. If you're like me, your life is pretty chaotic outside of your day to day. And the last thing I want to do is take someone's time and talent away from their family and friends when they may or may not get a job. And second, I think that it's automatically biased to people that maybe have better support systems and also have access to learning technologies, because a lot of learning managers sadly have shiny crow syndrome. And if you make something pretty, they're like, oh, they're an amazing instructional designer, because maybe you have your own license of some of these tools. But, you know, unfortunately, you might miss out on a candidate that didn't have the time to do that. So one thing that I do when I interview is I actually, in the middle of the interview, turn it over to them. And I said, I want you to share your screen. I want you to pick a portfolio entry that you have for me. Then I want you to talk me through your design process. So it's like they're doing a director's cut of it. And I'll ask questions throughout about, hey, why'd you do that? Or, you know, what were your thoughts behind that? And I can tell very quickly if they actually have what I call solid design thinking, or like a solid framework of building, versus if it's a template or not. Tim Slade said something one time that made me laugh. He said one time he was interviewing somebody that actually used one of his templates on their portfolio, which I thought was hilarious.
Oh, bloody hell. That's, I mean, as slip-ups go, like, if you're going to do it, at least keep track of who you've nicked your work from so you don't go to them for an interview. I mean, oh. Funnily enough, this is entirely non-L&D related. I made the same argument to my wife this afternoon because she was watching one of those like ghost hunting shows where they go into an old vanilla. It's a shadow. There's something coming through on the talking box. And I was like, they're not even good con people. Like, they could be associate and pretend to be scientific. No, they're just extreme. There's a shadow. It's heard this. Oh, everything's the most extreme possible story it could be. It's like, if you're going to lie to people, at least make it believable. You know?
Yeah.
If you're going to spin a story, make it a good one. Yeah.
Another example of that, I struggle with sleeping at night. My mind is one of those minds that race all the time. So a lot of times I'll listen to, like, people reading Reddit posts or something like that. But one thing that I love to watch when I fall asleep is The Curse of Oak Island. It's on the Discovery Channel, and it's about these two brothers that are trying to find this hidden treasure. I think that's part of Canada, like some province of Canada or island or something. And this thing
has something to do with the Templars, isn't it?
Maybe. Went on for like three or four seasons, and it drives my husband bananas. He's like, why are you watching? You know that, I mean, every little, it's like, it's good to fall asleep to. Just leave me alone. Just let me listen to it. But yeah, same thing.
But the sad thing is, you could take that sentiment and apply it to an awful lot of learning content out there. Great to fall asleep to. Just leave it on repeat in the background. It will keep going. You'll end up with like 16 badges to put on your LinkedIn profile at the end. It'll be great. And you'll get to sleep. So yeah, it's a funny space regarding that, isn't it?
It is.
So, yeah. So swinging round into that world as well. So obviously you share a lot with the industry. And I know you touched right at the start on kind of why you do that in terms of giving back. But we kind of discussed how difficult it is to find the right resources. So how do you go about your kind of personal development? Where do you find your resources to continue growing? And where did you find them when you were starting out?
Oh, great question. So I was also pretty fortunate when I moved to Columbus, Ohio, where I live now. I met this man, you may have heard of him, named Mike Taylor. And Mike Taylor is also a big person in the curation space. And he is very giving with his time. And he shared with me kind of his own personal management, strategy. And I think he also leaned into, is it Hirache? I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name that kind of has this framework. But essentially, mine is pretty simple. I love to read. So like as soon as I wake up in the morning, I usually spend at least an hour reading every morning. And I use this tool called Feedly that is an aggregator that brings in all these different resources on different topics. So there's different blogs I like to read. I'm really, I'll follow like different newsletters, that kind of stuff. But essentially, this is my litmus test. If I read something, and I was like, that's valuable. I share it. That's it. So if it's something that I'm like, this is valuable, or I think this, this can help me in some way, I can share it. So I use a tool called Buffer. And so I share the link, it sends it to my Buffer, then my Buffer will automatically post it for me throughout the day. So it'll post on my LinkedIn, set it, forget it. I get a lot of questions like, are you on LinkedIn all the time? No, I'm not. Actually, I'm not even checking my direct messages anymore because I just got so overwhelmed by them, because there were just so many evenings that like I would just look up and it'd be 11 o'clock at night, and I was like, I haven't ate dinner, like I've been answering messages all night, like this is not helping. And for what? Not to say that I don't care about helping people, but I'm taking time away from my family too, and it's like cost benefit analysis, probably not the best, right? So usually I'll get like different links. And then there's another tool that I use called Refine that I really like, that you can type in different topics that you like, and then it will aggregate and bring in different things that you may like. And I really like that as well. And it's easy. It's just five different links. I am on the Morning Brew bandwagon. I know a lot of people have talked about that, because now they have like an emerging tech and an HR version of it. That's pretty fascinating. So I'll subscribe to that. Tim Ferriss has a 5 Bullet Friday that I read, but any other kind of, I'd say, learning development newsletters from different people, I don't really subscribe to those or anything. But yeah, that's pretty much my process. And then usually if it's something really powerful, so like for example, one of my favorite articles I ever read was breaking down why level 1-1 in Super Mario Brothers is like the perfect learning experience. Because it was the tutorial level that didn't tell you it was a tutorial level, right? And I love that so much. So I will reshare that one specifically once a quarter, because I usually get new people following me and things. And selfishly, it's also something I like to reread multiple times, because it's just a really good reminder to just get out of your head and keep it as simple and clean as possible.
That's awesome. I think I kind of touched on before how quite often when I see people, read People almost seem aghast that that people could primarily learn from reading the written word in 2022. I was chatting to somebody, they were, oh, surely you must consume a lot more podcasts and videos and online courses than you do read. And I don't know, I'm not sure what your reasoning behind it is, but I just say this recording a podcast, I struggle to absorb something and analyze it as deeply as I would if it was written down, if I'm watching or listening to it, which maybe says something about how we should be designing certain types of learning as well. But I know certainly for me, if it's something, I don't know, certainly if it's something that kind of touches into the world of kind of, oh, we're gonna talk about some kind of science here, I kind of want that written down because I want to scribble on it and I highlight it and margin comment it and that kind of thing. I still have a printer, let's put it that way, that sees regular daily use. Just doing my bit to destroy the planet there.
I don't know about you, but I just get tired of being in front of my computer with a screen, you know, because I will just get in the flow and I'm just like, oh my goodness, it's the end of the day. I need to actually get up and move. So usually I just like to read. But, you know, if I'm consuming kind of media or whatever, it's usually like I've transitioned into video game brain. I play video games every day. I make time for video games every day, even if it's 30 minutes, just because one, it helps me decompress. But two, I've gotten so many amazing design ideas from just playing video games, even just like through the user experience or, you know, the storytelling or, you know, colors. I mean, there's just so much inspiration you can get from video games. But that is something I make time to do that every single day, unless I am traveling. And then I switched to mobile gaming, which is not my favorite. Although Apex Legends is now on mobile and I do like it. So we'll put that on out there. But I think it's really important. But yeah, same time, I enjoy reading and do get a lot of it as well, because you can really kind of linger on the words and just kind of let it set in your brain and then think about it. I think there's something really powerful about that.
So more serious question then, favorite video game?
Oh gosh, of all time, that's a really hard one. I would say probably of all time, and I share this with trepidation because they are remaking it and I'm scared to death, but probably Knights of the Old Republic Star Wars is probably my favorite game of all time. Okay. I am scared that they're remaking it because I love the Star Wars Battlefront games and I hate what EA did to them recently. I tried to have an open mind about it and I was not happy. But the reason that I love that game so much, Knights of the Old Republic, it's the first game I can remember playing that was this amazing kind of art. It was a role-playing game, but then you saw the effects of your choices. So I hope I'm not spoiling anything if you haven't played the game, but you essentially get to choose if you want to be like a Jedi or a Sith. I've never played the Jedi path, FYI. I always go real dark,
It's too much work. Yeah, no. Being good all the time. No.
Yeah, I go complete 100% Sith. But the challenge of the game is obviously you make these decisions that are kind of evil, but then you have a crew of people around you, and there's different degrees of difficulty because they struggle with kind of their own morality and what they want to do. And there's one character in particular that is super hard to get dark side. And I've even watched, I don't know how many guides about it, but like you get one shot to turn this person dark side. And the challenge of that is something that I always look forward to. And I find myself, that's another game I replay at least once a year. My husband hates it. He thinks it's the most boring game on the planet, but I love it. And then I'm also a big platformer fan, so probably my favorite platformer game, Super Mario Brothers 3. I love it so much, especially because I am so much better at it than my husband. He's not a platformer fan. Like, he falls off the cliff and I just laugh and he gets so mad at me. I really enjoy that game too.
Good answers that relate back to what we're talking about otherwise. I like that. That's good. And yeah. But yes, Knights of the Old Republic is a phenomenal game. If for no other reason than the cutscenes.
Those are good too.
Masterpieces. Yes. Especially when you consider the age. Like, it doesn't look like a game of its age. It's quite impressive.
I agree.
So then, going off on a completely different direction. Here's a topic that I've been not struggling with, but thinking about a lot recently, and I can't quite make my mind up on like a a set position. And I think you might have an interesting take on it.
Oh, no.
I'm sure you'll have an interesting take on it. I think everyone does. What do you think L&D's role is in terms of kind of equity, diversity and inclusion in the workplace? It is a tricky one.
No, I think we carry the torch, right? Because we have the potential to impact everyone in our organizations. And so if not us, then who, right? And so, mm-hmm. you know, I think that we need to consider how to have those difficult conversations. You know, I was in a conversation earlier today and a question came up about accessibility. Like, you know, when you design, do you, you know, kind of design assuming that you need to have different pieces in your design process, or is it something that you kind of audience? And I very bluntly said, no, I design as accessible as I can on the front end, because retrofitting is a nightmare. And two, it's the right thing to do. Like, everyone can benefit from some of these functionalities of assistive, accessible, you know, components in a learning experience, right? So I think that we have a big role to play in it. Now, checking my privilege here as a heterosexual white person, you know, there's a lot that I certainly don't understand about, you know, that journey that people go on, but I can listen. And I think really the biggest thing that I've learned, especially in the last couple of years, is, you know, to believe people and their experiences matter. And there's a lot that we can learn from the experiences of other people. And we don't necessarily have to say anything. Like, even just listening is a good start. And you would be surprised how many people don't even do that.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's really interesting, because my kind of uncertainty with it, I think, is at least partially being, especially in Britain, you go middle class white male. Yep, mine is the voice that needs to be heard here. On we go, which is always a little bit tricky. But I think more so, I think the fact that it's been done so badly, and yeah. so it took by what I've seen, because what I've seen is a lot of content being pushed out that is, what is racism and what is this and what is that, and awareness of this one and the next thing. And I'm kind of thinking from a workplace L&D perspective, I kind of look at it and think, awareness of what is insert issue here is not the problem. If someone's doing it, they don't care. Because I don't think anyone at this day and age is going, oh, I didn't know there was this thing called racism. I had no idea I was supposed to be a decent human being to everyone. I feel like we have to get past that and into that kind of, we're going to have conversations that people are going to find really uncomfortable, and they're just going to have to go with it. And I guess part of that is the capability in L&D has to change to be able to make that happen. And maybe I've just not seen that happen yet. I think it's interesting.
It would be easier if we were in the manipulation business, but we can't change someone's heart on the surface, right? Mm. I think that really for it to be successful, it's going to have to be multifaceted in organizations. We're going to have the partnership of the leadership of the organization. And I said this in my Disrupt HR talk that I did a month or so ago, is that, you know, bottom line is, no matter how much stock art you have, all the high fives and, you know, the awards you pay for being the best workplaces of whatever, the culture of your organization is the behavior that it tolerates. That's it. Don't matter what your statement is on it, whatever culture is, whatever behavior is tolerated, that is the culture of the organization. And L&D, we can't train that out of people. That has to be enforced, and we have to have partnership from our leaderships in our organizations in order to truly make a difference. So I think, to your point, I think that's why a lot of it fails, because it's like, oh, you can train it out of them, or, oh, you know, you just make them aware and that's good enough. No, that's just step one. Step two is, how do you enforce it? How do you say that that's what you value, right? I've seen a lot of folks talk about kind of this performative allyship, especially during the month of June with Pride, right? It's like, oh, make your logo rainbow, but then show me the, you know, policies of you know, helping people that maybe have different needs in the organization. You would probably be surprised on the, you know, the way that it's handled. So I think it all boils down to, again, partnership and making sure that the organization is supporting what it is that they're saying that they support. Because at the end of the day, what's the point if you don't have kind of that backup to enforce the culture that you're wanting to build?
I think it's one of those topics where I think it's gonna take a long time, certainly for me, to get to grips with where I think I stand in it. But I think it's one of those topics where you know you need to do something. You just got to figure out exactly how you're gonna make it work, right? That's awesome. Well, I know we're coming up on time, but I always just like to finish off by just saying, hey, look, if there was one message, one thing that you're thinking of. This message to, I always say the L&D world, but it's like the listenership of this podcast. It's not quite the L&D world, not yet. You know, this episode, kind of a small pocket of the internet. Next episode, probably the same small pocket of the internet, but you know, we can dream. What would be that kind of final thought from yourself?
Easy. Tell somebody that you love them today, because tomorrow's not guaranteed.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Ideas Podcast. You can find links on how to get in touch with Kara in the description of the episode. If you enjoyed this or learnt something, please do let us know in the comments and remember to hit the like button and subscribe on YouTube. If there's someone in your network who you think would benefit from this show, please do share it with them. And if you have something you'd like to share, get in touch today to come on the show.